Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Welcome to Friday Week in Review time.
If committing to signing a guarantee today is what's required to move forward, then Boston is no longer pursuing the 2024 Olympic and Paralympic Games.
And so the week began on Monday with Mayor Marty Walsh's death blow to Boston's bid for the Olympic Games. Mere hours later, the USOC pulled its support as well, eliciting some told-you-sos from Olympic opponents.
They bought something, some cross between a pipe dream and a hallucination from Boston 2024. And then I think they never should have picked Boston in the first place.
And other told-you-sos from Olympics supporters.
I think we really had a chance to do something huge for Boston, and I think we failed.
But can the legacy of Boston 2024's failed bid be a better Boston, even without the Games? Both sides certainly hope so.
We need to take kind of the shell of 2024 and use that as the catalyst. And let's find a solution to the T. Let's find a solution to our highways. Let's build housing on some of these neighborhoods. Let's address some of these same issues that all of us agree on and use that same year as the catalyst to get it done.
Lofty goals. And let's talk about them and the rest of the week's news with Boston Globe's columnist Joan Vinocchi. Joan, great to see you.
Nice to be here.
Also with us is former Republican State Senator Richard Tesei. Happy Friday to you, Richard.
Happy to be here as well.
It's great to have both of you. So let's start with that last piece of tape we heard and potential goals coming out of the end of Boston's bid for the Olympic Games. I mean, do you still think that there's a good path forward in rebuilding neighborhoods, you know, redesigning areas, giving us new venues that maybe could have been useful? Richard?
Well, I do think that this whole process was unusual in the sense that it really got people to focus in on what maybe improvements are needed in Boston and what the future of the city could look like when it comes to transportation and housing. I don't know how much work has been done on a master plan for the city, but certainly, again, having just gone through what we did, I think a lot of issues came up. And, you know, I just heard in your intro about this. Last time I was here, I compared the Olympics to Cape Wind, just saying it was a huge project, it wasn't going to go anywhere. And I think Joan and I were proven right on that. But I do think that, you know, when you think about this, I really do think that the Big Dig hangover is something that was on people's mind and maybe one of the reasons that public opinion didn't quite come around to this and why they had such a hard time convincing the public.
Yeah, the fool me once, fool me twice issue, Joan.
Well, I wrote, and I believe that the people that oppose this were heroes, not naysayers, cynics, and spoilers. I still don't get it, why we need an Olympics to fix the T and do smart development. Cities across America do that without an Olympics. The last Olympic that was held here was when? Atlanta? 20 years ago.
Yep.
So I don't see that as this pivotal thing that now we will never get anything done. If we don't, shame on us.
Right. Well, today, the mayor wrote in an op-ed that there may never be an Olympic stadium built in Wadette Circle, but there could be new retail and office space. There could be beautiful open space and parks. There could be thousands of affordable housing units, which we need in order to accommodate our city's rapidly growing population of young professionals, families, and seniors. So maybe, you know, even though he once was a strong supporter of the Olympics, the mayor echoing what you said, that we don't really need it.
Absolutely. I mean, Wadette Circle, if there were a stadium, that meant between now and 2024, none of that development could happen. They'd have to be building this temporary stadium. Now there's nothing between Wadette Circle and the development that he's talking about. Just if he wants tax breaks, if he wants some sort of tax package, offer it up. Yeah. I mean, I don't see why it can't be done.
Richard, you were in state government, though, right? So, and the one thing that keeps coming back to me is for some of the people who were staunch supporters of Boston 2024, they said, yeah, you know, we can do this, but state government needs a deadline, and there's nothing like the Olympics to provide the deadline and therefore the motivation.
Apparently, for the Olympics, the deadline was last week, and when, you know, it really came to be. Yeah, you do need something. You know, it's funny, I sell real estate, and I just sold a house where somebody did over their whole house because their daughter was getting married, and they were going to have the reception at the house. And, you know, so the Olympics, I guess you could have looked at it in the same sense that, you know, with a big event coming, you try to spruce up the city and you try to do these things, but you don't really need that necessarily. I agree with Joan. I mean, everybody knows that we have an infrastructure problem when it comes to transportation. Everybody knows we have a housing shortage. And I do think that having a good master plan in place in Boston will go a long ways towards helping remake the city.
Just very quickly, I don't think Governor Baker needed a 2024 deadline to fix the T.
No, he got the winter instead,
right? If it's going to take him that long, I don't know if he'll be sticking around that long.
Right. In fact, the state transportation secretary, Stephanie Pollack, sat at right in this place you're sitting not that long ago and said, shame on us if we needed the Olympics to fix the T after the winter we have. But you mentioned Governor Baker, and he spoke yesterday at the opening of the Boston Public Market, a new indoor market for New England products near the Haymarket. And he was there with Mayor Marty Walsh. And as he opened the space, the governor said this.
So what do you think? A market like this or a velodrome?
And then he shot a glance toward Mayor Walsh, who joined in the laughter. But Joan and Richard, I mean, in terms of political leadership, both from Governor Baker and Mayor Walsh, how do you think they handled this long downward saga?
Well, for Governor Baker, I got to say he was thrown into this because if you remember inaugural day, rather than concentrating on his message as the new governor, there was a lot of euphoria because a bid was announced that day. And I think if probably anybody's responsible for slowing things down and maybe not having it, it's probably Governor Baker because, you know, he said, hey, guys, you know, he wasn't involved in the planning or getting him to that point. And I think he did the sensible thing by asking to have a study done and seeing what the economic impacts were going to be. So I would just say that, you know, I think he handled it right. Mayor Walsh is probably a little more, you know, he started off with pom-poms, cheering, and then ended up doing a complete about face. And clearly he had to have known at the beginning that there, you know, that he was going to be required to sign a, you know, some type of agreement to cover the overruns. Yeah. And all of a sudden, you know, way down the road to turn around and say, ah, you know, this is a surprise to me.
Exactly.
Can't do it. I think he probably ends up looking a little worse.
Joan?
Well, we have to stop agreeing like this, but I agree. I think it's a little bit more problematic for the mayor. He was for it and against it. As time moved forward and opposition grew and the poll numbers sunk, I think he saw it as a political albatross, and he found a way to get out from under it in a relatively good way on Monday. But as Richard said, he knew what was in that thing that he signed.
And from the beginning.
From the beginning. And either he thought he was going to somehow get it out or he was going to finesse it, and I'm not sure what he was thinking.
Yeah. Okay, so before we leave the issue of the Olympics, there's one thing I really want to ask both of you. On the show earlier this week, we had Mike Ross on, you know, former city councilor. Great guy, very thoughtful person. There's something that he said that's really stuck with me because it really strikes at the soul of the city. I mean, he was a big supporter of having the Olympic Games here. He is a big supporter. And he said, this just makes Boston look small. And Mike told us, you know, we can't pull off the Olympics. You know, it doesn't matter that we were the vanguard for universal health care in America. It doesn't matter that we've got world-class universities. I mean, those things aren't small, but it's not the same as hosting the Olympics. So, I mean, I personally have struggled with that because I don't think it's small to be the leader on same-sex marriage, to be the leader on health care, to be the leader in education. But, you know, it seems like some people do think that we still need a giant international event to prove our largesse on the world stage.
I disagree. I think it makes Boston look smart. I think the Olympics is not the brand it used to be anyway, and that people who think that it is are hearkening back to the Miracle on Ice, actually hearkening back to the 20th century, and that today's young people don't view the Olympics the way people... I know Mike Ross isn't that old, but I just think it's an old-fashioned way of looking at the world and defining success.
Hmm.
And I don't think we really lost anything at all with this. And, you know, Boston's a desirable city. We have so much history, so much to offer. We're always going to be a popular destination for people from all over the world. So you can do that without... Again, I said it earlier, I do think people had a lot of fatigue. Everybody lived through the big dig. And, you know, no matter what day, time of day it is, getting in and out of this city is hard enough already. And I think a lot of people looked at the Olympics thinking, that's going to be a lot of inconvenience.
Yeah. And Mike, if you're listening, you're a friend of the show. We always welcome your thoughts here, regardless of whether or not everyone at the table agrees with you. But let's turn to another saga, this one that's gone on for almost as long as the story of the Olympics bid, and that is Deflategate.
For reasons that I cannot comprehend, there are those in the league office who are more determined to prove that they were right rather than admit any culpability of their own or take any responsibility for the initiation of a process and ensuing investigation that was flawed. I've come to the conclusion that this was never about doing what was fair and just.
All right, well, that's Pat's owner, Robert Kraft, shaking his head at NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell's decision to uphold Tom Brady's 4-game suspension for his alleged involvement in Deflategate. Okay, so, Richard, let's start with you. I mean, Tom Brady's going to take this to court. I mean, your response to the continuation, the upholding of the suspension.
Well, I think I think Tom Brady going to court is a huge mistake.
And
I think it's, oh, yeah, without a doubt. And I think the longer this goes on, the worse it's going to be for the Patriots.
But he's saying he's doing it in part to, like, you know, protect other players.
The worse it's going to be for him and the sport. I think really gets hurt by it. And I just look at this. I don't know if I'm listening to another Lois Lerner or, you know, destroying her hard drive computer, or Hillary with her server in her house, you know, destroying that. You
Brady
know,
and his phone.
And his phone. And I just think it's very damning. And, you know, he should just quit while he's ahead at this point. Because once you get into a court of law that's different from, you know, the court of public opinion are operating within the league, and I don't see what he has to gain.
Okay, Joan.
I thought we would finally disagree, but I find myself agreeing with you. I say I agree with you. I think he is pushing this way too far. But yeah, he wants to go to court. Go to court. I want to hear him testify under oath. I want to hear those equipment managers under oath tell us what happened, what they were told or not told. I think that would bring clarity if they're willing to testify under oath and say that nobody ever told them to deflate footballs or whatever. Maybe then I'd believe them.
Okay, so we're focusing on Tom Brady here, but shouldn't the focus really be on Roger Goodell? Because a lot of commentators have said, look, it's good that Brady's taking this to court because he's forcing the question about the sort of haphazard way in which Goodell's been parceling out, you know, different punishments for different players, you know, for the past couple of years.
This is the National Football League, and, you know, the commissioner of the National Football League should be the person who runs the National Football League. Should all be handled within the National Football League. If you don't, you know, I mean, the whole idea of taking this to court, I think, is ridiculous. And I'm telling you, I really do think this is going to boomerang on Tom Brady, and he's going to wish that. And the Players Association will probably wish that they hadn't taken that route.
I think you're listening to too much sports talk radio.
I cannot believe I'm finding myself being the defender of Tom Brady. But all right, so
I like Tom Brady. I like the Patriots. I'll put that right out there right now. But I mean, you know, quit while you're ahead.
Hey,
they already paid $1 million, right? They already lost 2 draft picks. What does it matter at this point? What's the point of moving forward with it? Just get on with the season, and hopefully this will be a successful one.
I might dabble on WEEI every once in a while, Joan. Come on. Well, let's hear from another voice in this story, and that is New England Patriots coach Bill Belichick. Here he is.
We're going to continue to get the team ready for the 2015 season. That's what we're going to do.
How difficult is getting ready when you may not know who your quarterback will be for the first 4 games?
All the players that are out there will practice. It's like they always do.
But you don't know who's going to be in the game, so that makes it difficult to get the reps and quarterback.
We practice everybody in training camp. That's what training camp's for. That's the way we've always done it, and that's the way we'll do it this year. It's no different than any other position or any other year.
Bill Belichick responding just like he always does. But I feel like he's being a little bit disingenuous. It's not just any other position or any other person. I mean, it's Tom Brady as the Patriots quarterback.
It's on to Cincinnati with Bill Belichick. I think he should give training camp lessons to Hillary Clinton and Jeb Bush and the people running for president, because he stonewalls the press like no one I know.
The man is on, he's an on-message machine, that's for sure. All right, let's move on to another story this week, and that is the sales tax holiday, because typically it costs around $25 million in lost tax revenue for the state. And this year there was some pretty robust debate over whether or not the tax holiday is a net positive and for whom. Now, lawmakers did pass the holiday for next month. It's going to be on August 15th and 16th. It awaits Governor Baker's signature, and he said he was going to sign the bill. But we've got some tape here from House Speaker Robert DeLeo. He talked to reporters before the vote on the sales tax holiday, and he said he does have concern about what it does to the government's coffers, but he also knows that businesses and consumers like it.
Talking to some of the smaller retail folks at the local level, you know, they tell me about the importance of such a holiday, especially in terms of what goes on in the slower month of August. Talking to the consumers as well, when kids are about to go ready to school, they find it valuable as well.
So, Richard, I mean, there's a really important question here. I mean, is losing that $25 million in tax revenue, does it hurt the state?
Well, I think the fact that you have to have a tax holiday tells you that taxes are too high in the first place. And I think at the end of the day, it all evens out, whether you're losing, you know, the revenue over that period of time or longer. And when I would talk to local, people who own businesses, they would tell me, yeah, everybody will come in those 2 days, and then after that, you're dead for, you know, the next month.
Right.
Or you're dead the month before because everybody's anticipating the sales tax holiday. And I just, you know, I always thought it was gimmicky. I'd vote for it. I'd hold my nose and vote for it. But, you know, at the end of the day, the sales tax is too high, particularly if you live up in Merrimack Valley or some of the border communities to New Hampshire where there's no sales tax there. So every day's a sales tax holiday, you know, in New Hampshire.
Uh-huh.
And it puts a lot of businesses here at a competitive disadvantage. We have to be losing $100 million a year in sales tax revenue to New Hampshire.
Right.
Because people crossing the border.
Go ahead, Joan.
The psychology is greater than the facts in this case. It's kind of like, reminds me of the film tax credit. You could have all these studies that show that you lose money by doing it, but there's still this sense like, oh my goodness, you know, no one will, movies won't come here and film, and isn't that a terrible thing? The same kind of thing at work here.
Oh, people won't buy their washing machines.
People won't buy their refrigerators or their flat screen TVs. And Richard just said it. He held his nose and voted, and that's what everybody does. I don't have to vote, so it's easy for me to say.
I mean, we've been doing this for many years now. I mean, Joan, do you think because of exactly what you just said that every year we're going to have the same conversation over and over again, even if it's kind of a zero-sum game?
Goes around in circles, and until enough people are willing to vote against it, which doesn't ever seem to be the case, you have the debate and you come to the same conclusion.
Or enough people who are willing to vote to lower that tax, at least back to 5%.
You forever will hold out that hope.
At least back to 5% where it was. But, you know, maybe here on the border communities a little lower to just so that it's competitive. That would do more to help the economy than a single weekend of of a sales tax holiday.
Okay. Well, and Joan, actually, let me ask you about that. So, I mean, Richard is actually prescribing a deeper solution here rather than just, you know,
a
weekend.
Well, it would be interesting to see if Governor Baker would go along with that, because then he would, by lowering the sales tax, he'd also be lowering revenue. And when you lower revenue, you create budget deficits.
Right.
So that's another reason why it doesn't happen. It's easy to call for it, but to actually make it happen means taking a hit on the other side.
Yeah. Well, you know, we've got enough time today to have a thoughtful reflection on our hubbubs. And those are the stories that maybe didn't make it to the top of the newscast or above the fold, as we might say. And Richard, let's start with you. What is your hubbub?
Oh, you think Tom Brady had a bad week. Giselle, his wife, apparently had a little tougher week, and it wasn't this week, but apparently about a month ago, she was in Paris. She went to an appointment to a doctor. I guess it was a plastic surgeon. So in order to disguise herself, she dressed herself in a burqa.
Oh, boy.
And that created a number of problems for her because she did it during the holy month of Ramadan, and a lot of people were offended when things came to light. And she was also wearing open-toed sandals, mm-hmm. which is a definite no-no as well. So there were people at that. But she also created a furor because in France, the burqa has been illegal for women to wear since 2010. So she created a bit of an international incident. So I'm sure when Tom came home and was upset about the way things are going this week, she probably had her own stories to tell. So they probably, they're probably resting at the end of this week and just saying what happened this week.
And there's no fine for bad taste, unfortunately. Joan, what's your hubbub?
Well, mine isn't as sexy as that, but it's about Steve Wynn and his never-ending effort to get that casino built in Everett. He's been making remarks that the welcome mat is not out for him, which is a bit of an understatement as it applies to Marty Walsh in the city of Boston. And I think that Wynn may be playing off a little bit of this Olympics fiasco, thinking that for those people that think the Olympics show that Boston can't get anything done, that this is another example of not being able to do business in Massachusetts, and that if he kind of shames the mayor, that things will move along and Marty Walsh will withdraw his suits and he'll finally get that casino built. But there still are serious traffic issues out there about the casino.
Oh, yes.
And all the talk about a welcome mat and all that shouldn't distract from the fact that there are serious traffic issues. The people of Charlestown have a real stake in how that's settled. And I don't think the mayor should back down on it.
Okay. Well, mine is sort of also, my hubbub is related to the city. Have you heard of the address 200 Clarendon? Crickets? Silence? Yes, that's because nobody calls it that, right? We all know it as the Hancock Tower. But we found out this week because the Hancock Company no longer occupies any space in that giant glass edifice, that they can no longer, technically Boston Properties, which owns the Hancock Tower, cannot call it that anymore. So they've tried to come up with new names, like 200 Clarendon, I guess, as a nod to its actual address. But I dare anybody to tell the average Bostonian, like, you cannot call it the Hancock Tower anymore, right? Like, who would do that?
I can't imagine. But it does show you it's definitely a new Boston if there's no longer John Hancock Insurance Company in the Hancock Tower.
Yeah. Didn't we go through this with the garden, the Fleet Center?
Oh, that's right.
And then it was TD.
TD, then the TD Bank North, and now it's back to the TD Garden. And we still call it the Garden. Well, in honor of the Hancock Tower, I just thought I'd read a little bit from John Updike, who actually wrote about it in one of his classic short stories, Gesturing. He called it a disaster that sat lightly on the city's heart. Because remember, when it was built 47 years ago, the big glass panes were falling off the side of the building. So he wrote that, this is Updike, the skyscraper, for years suspended in a famous state of incompletion, was a beautiful disaster. Famous because it was a disaster, glass kept falling from it, and disastrous because it was beautiful. The architect had had a vision. He had dreamed of an invisible building, though immense. The glass was meant to reflect the sky and the old low brick skyline of Boston, and to melt into the sky. So I have to say that regardless of what we call it, the building does that. It's still one of my favorite buildings in Boston.
It is a beautiful building.
Yeah. So thank you, John Updike, for immortalizing the Hancock Tower, regardless of what we call it. That's it for our Week in Review today. Boston Globe columnist Joan Vinocchi, it was really great to have you. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And former Republican State Senator Richard Tissay, always great to have you.
Pleasure
thank you so
to
much.
See you.
Great weekend to both of you. Stick with us. When we come back, we'll talk about privately owned public spaces in Boston, and we'll also go to the Newport Jazz Festival. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.